Didn't you just love that children's story? What I find the most difficult part of that children's story, and I don't know where you are, if you have ever argued with somebody that you love and care about, was after the anger comes the realization you're by yourself. You're isolated. That's a pivotal moment in relationships. Because what do you do at that point? Pretend it never happened? Go off and do something else? Harden your heart? Or, as in the story, come and apologize and reconcile? I just thought that was good. Well, we are all here today, bodily present. So I guess there's no true believers here. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, the world didn't end.
The world did not end. But
you never noticed.
Yeah, I know. But the headlines this morning, I thought, rumors proven false. I thought, if I'm here to read that, you know. But I was, you know, we've been talking about in the past several months about not being captured by particular belief systems, but that belief systems are guides to help us navigate in this world. And so if we're so attached to a particular belief, then maybe, you know, we can't navigate into new territory, or curiosity can't get in because of belief won't let it. And I was read a bit about, I think his name was Harold Camping, the person who promoted the belief that the rapture was going to happen and occur. And it was a quote by his daughter that said he was bewildered. So here's somebody that has an attachment to a belief so intensely that it's absolutely going to happen, and when it doesn't, there's bewilderment. And I thought, well, that's a perfect example or a danger of being so attached to a particular belief that we become bewildered, disoriented, lost when that belief is not true. And I know the story of the rapture and that theological belief, because that was my introduction to the church, into a church like that, when I went to a church. And I was listening to a preacher, Adrian Rogers. I don't know if you know him. God help me. I don't know why I was listening to him, but I was listening to him. He's one of the 10 that helped with the Southern Baptist Convention takeover and those things. And it was curious. And since I've got this new attitude working in my spiritual life, that I am, you are, as we talked about last week, the universe reflecting upon itself, and trying to understand and grapple with the meaning of that and how that might influence my life, change my life, transform me. And I think I saw a couple incidences of that this week. And what Adrian Rogers was saying is that when Jesus comes back, he's coming back vengefully. Now, I know that's not true, actually, in that particular model of belief. Because when Jesus comes back, people are raptured and they go to heaven and they go to the marriage feast of the Lamb, and there's peace on earth for 3.5 years, and then there's big wars after that, and Jesus comes back and sets up a 1,000-year kingdom, 1,000-year reign, and that kind of thing. So it's not congruent with his belief. And so I got to thinking, what in the world is that person doing telling people that their spiritual figure that they love, that they seek salvation from, that they seek, you know, they seek comfort from, that figure, that at the same time they have to hold an image of that figure coming back in their mind with vengeance. So you can see that there's a dualism there. One hears love and one hears vengeance. And I was trying to figure it out. And where I got with that was how sad that must be to have to live with that. That to have a religious sensibility in which there's love from a person you care about, from your spiritual figure, but that also your spiritual figure is going to be vengeful to others, to hurt others. Because I know that in a home, when people are growing up, and from a child's perspective, if you have a parent who is hurtful or abusive, and at other times kind and generous, you live in a state of anxiety. Because you don't know when the hurtfulness is going to come to you. So you orchestrate your whole life, you orchestrate your whole behavior, not the unfolding of your natural self, not to be who you are or to unfold your gifts or to participate in this world for who you are. You organize your whole life so that you don't get that wrath upon you. That's how that works. And so to me, that theological belief comes after that particular family of origin dynamic. That here's love and here's hate, and you have to organize your behavior so you don't get the anger on you and keep yourself safe. I think historically I might have just blown that off, or you know, I wish they'd get their theology straight, or you know, what are they thinking? But this week when I heard that, there was sorrow and a sadness there. Another example how I think that that phrase and belief that we are the universe reflecting upon itself affected me. I was working with that and trying to imagine, and I don't know if you've done that this week, what does that mean? That I am, you are the universe reflecting upon itself. Trying to get a handle on that in my mind, and an image came to me, and I thought I had a pretty broad perspective. You know, I try to have my own personal life perspective and community perspective historically and reflect upon that. I try to reflect, goodness gracious, you know, on the history of corporations and how that influences us. You get enough of that. You know, and I try to reflect on the origins of those kind of things, of how our culture evolves and who we are, to make sure we're not captured by a context, not captured by a belief system, so that when I speak, I can say, you know, this could be problematic, this could be okay. And I was trying to grapple with that, and then I'm trying to think, okay, and I've got the evolution, you know, I've got a picture of the Earth completely covered with ice, and try to make sense out of that, and the Big Bang and all that kind of stuff. But what occurred to me when I was integrating that new thought into my mind was that my reflection and my meaning-making process, as broad as I thought it was, right? It's how we think of ourselves, maybe, was very narrow. It was human-centered. It was human-centric, I guess you might say, in that it was the human culture that I was reflecting upon, not the entire universe, or not the movement of the whole Earth, not that movement, but and I don't know what that means for me yet. And how that, but I do know there's something changing, because now as I kind of grapple with that particular belief, there's a 360 degree meaning to that in my imagination, and to the best that I at least interpret myself to be spiritually, I probably had about 20 degrees occupied. Now there's this emptiness out there, which is kind of exciting, because what will happen with that? Where will that go? What will that be? So I can remember one time when I was in clinical training, you know, there was this one supervisor that wanted your whatever you turned in to be polished, spit shine, boom, you know, all the I's dotted and T's crossed and that kind of thing. And so that's what we did. Then there was this other supervisor, which I liked better, and he would say, "Now I want to see the process of your thinking." Because if I don't see the process of your thinking, I can't help you as you're moving along. And if I have to see the final product of what you're doing, then I really can't help you along the way, because you're already there, and more than likely you're going to get defensive if I do try to help. And in a way, so that's what I'm trying to do with that new thought, is share my process of how that is integrated in a spiritual process, growth, I guess, or change or transformation, because even with today's sermon, I'm looking at it from two different perspectives now. So I'm kind of dual-minded in a way. I'm looking at it from this new perspective of the universe reflecting upon itself, and what does that mean, and leaning that way, and the perspective that I had created in myself from my history, interpreting it from that perspective. So if it's confusing, that's why. So now you know. Whenever a faith tradition such as ours engages in the thought and process of another tradition, you have two histories in a way coming together in dialogue. And when that occurs, there's always a danger that if I'm not real secure in my history, I'll shift over to this next history way of thinking. And if I'm not real secure with that and I learn another history, I'll shift over to another history. And so I'm not real sure of my position. And sometimes I think we Unitarian Universalists, we get a bit like that because we do take pride in ourselves that we have access in our libraries, Christian tradition, Jewish tradition, Buddhist tradition, Hindu tradition. We have Native American tradition on our libraries, and we can go to eat all of those and to help us in our spiritual pilgrimage. But sometimes what I find myself doing is just a brief reading in many of them and not a depth reading in one of them. So you have to be kind of careful. But when we do claim ourselves as Unitarian Universalists, we do claim a particular position. We claim a position that starts in 1500, and we've gone over the Socinian history, and we claim a position with the Transcendentalists, with Emerson, Thoreau, Margaret Fuller. We claim in our tradition to the protest against social injustice, and when people are treated not as equally as other is our position. And I remember this learning from a theologian, H. Richard Niebuhr, when he's talking about histories engaging one another. And he says that your faith tradition has an internal history, and that you need to know that internal history pretty solidly, because that's where you stand, that's your identity. And then you will bump into other histories. And in those other histories, your boundaries need to be loose enough so that if you read something that's really good, you can incorporate it and bring it into your internal history and make it part of who you are. The danger, if you are so locked into your identity and your own history, no matter what you bump into, nothing new can get in. For example, Howard Camping of the rumor of the rapture thing. I mean, he was so locked into that, nothing new could get in. But he'd sell his house, sold all his goods. Nothing new could get in because he was so locked into it. So today when we look at this Bodhicitta Buddhist teaching, we don't look at it as Unitarian Universalists looking to become Buddhist. We look at it as Unitarian Universalists, is there something in this teaching that we can incorporate into our Unitarian Universalism that would deepen our spirituality and move us to be kinder and more compassionate people to ourselves, particularly with this teaching, to ourselves, and then to others? And so that's what we're doing as Unitarian Universalists. We're looking at another history, in a sense, another faith system, and we're saying, is there something here that can help us deepen our faith, deepen our spirituality? And so we enter into a dialogue with it. I'm drawn to especially the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh. I don't know if you're familiar with the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh. And this is one reason why, because in a Buddhist teaching and in our traditions, when you read in our hymnal, it says we are committed to direct experience. And Thich Nhat Hanh is a Buddhist monk from Vietnam. He's got a place in France right now and has written many things. But one thing, when I was reading from his book a couple days ago, Living Buddha, Living Christ, he's telling a story about mindfulness and how to maintain mindfulness in your active, in your daily lives, and maintaining that centeredness and maintaining that heart of love and compassion as you go about your day. And I think, yeah, that sounds really good. I like that. And then he goes on further and says that during the Vietnam War, they invented engaged mindfulness. And what he was referring to is that as he's attending to the suffering that was caused during the Vietnam War in North Vietnam, his Buddhism disciplined him enough that as he's attending to that suffering, he could maintain his mindfulness. He could maintain his heart of compassion and his heart of love as he's attending to the suffering that occurred because of the Vietnam War. And I thought, there's something there for me. Because if there was an invading force in Florida, bombing, shooting, killing, maiming, I'm not sure I could have that heart of compassion and love as I'm attending to the suffering of those events. I'm not sure hatred would not well up in me and take over and cause me to respond back and go fight. Or something. I have trouble maintaining that peaceful, compassionate, loving heart when I watch today's news. I find myself reacting. Or I'm in a conversation with somebody and they mention they support certain people. I'm having trouble with that. To get to the place where I would have the discipline and the maturity. So I ask, how do you get there? How do you achieve the and I'm going to call it maturity. I don't know a better word for it, spiritual maturity. Come to a place where I can maintain a centeredness and an attitude of love and compassion where the very things that I value are being destroyed, are being attacked. Bodhicitta is the way to move in that direction from the Buddhist perspective. So is there something there that could help us Unitarian Universalists if we think that's a worthy direction to go?
Yeah.
I do. And again, with all things, you just can't, it's like I was talking about last week, you can't take a belief, religious, philosophical belief, like I am the universe reflecting upon itself. That's a 4-year process to understand that. That's not something you can just grasp. And when I read the intention of Bodhicitta, the intention is everything with the Bodhisattva vows. We take vows purely for the sake of others. Only when we dedicate for the sake of others and try our best to put what we have learned into practice will our practice become truly beneficial. The Bodhicitta is a mind totally dedicated to others and achieving full enlightenment in order to benefit all sentient beings as fully as possible. Now, as a trained Western modern therapist, I'm going, no, that's codependent. No, that's... What are they talking about there? That I dedicate my life to the benefit of others, purely. See, in our culture, Western culture, since the 70s, we've identified that behavior, just that sentence, that you sacrifice your life for the benefit of others, just that sentence, we would call that codependent addictive behavior and something we need to do. We numb to that. If that's all I read and that's all I understood, I could go there and just kind of dismiss that and say, no, that's not for me. But we do have that in other traditions. In the Christian tradition, when you read in the New Testament, the biblical text, Christ came to serve. I mean, you have all the stories of Him washing the feet and serving others. And when you... Pure, true Christianity is about serving others, not about dominating, but about humbly serving. This is in that same kind of teaching. And there's two aspects to the body, seat, and mind, is what they call it. And the two aspects are aspirational and engaged. And in the aspirational bodhicitta is the complete wish to overcome our emotional afflictions and delusions to realize our full potentials to bring our fellow beings to the enlightened state free from suffering. Okay, so the first is you know, you hate to say desire when you talk about Buddhism, because you're not supposed to have desire, because you have desire, that's craving, and craving causes suffering. But it gets complicated that way. But here is the aspirational position, is to have the wish to overcome our emotional afflictions and delusions to realize our full potential to bring our fellow beings to enlightened state free from suffering. That means I've got to look in the mirror, as the rabbit and the bear looked in the mirror, and when I see myself, I've got to say, do I have emotional afflictions, and do I live with delusions? The assumption from this position is yes, you do. That you have emotional afflictions, and that you do function in delusions. Now see, later on, after you mature, there's this thing that if you're a bodhisattva and you're practicing bodhicitta, that you are to confront your fellows if you see them functioning in the delusion. Now my initial playful self says, oh good, I get to tell people that they're delusional, functioning in delusion, and I'm right, you know? Yeah, right. Yeah, I like that. I can go for that. I think that's probably where the humility comes in. So I have work to do. I have work to do. Since that was my first thought. Get them. I think that's where most of us are. That we wish to be psychologically, spiritually healthier. And that if we know that I'm afflicted, or if we know that I have internalized behaviors from my history that get in the way of my best self, that get in the way of me potentializing my best self. And as we've talked before, if I have scripts, or I play scapegoat, or I play hero, or I'm indirect with my anger, or I'm not taking care of myself the best that I can, these are scripts from our childhood, and that's what they're saying. That's what this is saying, that you need to attend to that. You need to deal with that in some way. And I'm going, you live in this culture. You suffer. I mean, it cannot not be so. It's the way it is. We live in a culture that has normalized anxiety and depression, and rather than change the culture, they make medication for us. That's true. Now, in some places, if we discover the sources of anxiety and depression, we would change our way of life so that anxiety and depression wouldn't be a normal response. But anxiety and depression is a normal response in our culture. It's a great book by Chelsea Glendening. Hi, my name is Chelsea, and I'm in recovery from Western civilization. It does a wonderful job at talking about that. And then there's a reason why I'm motivated to confront these things that I have internalized from my history. It's just not that in this bodhicitta, it's just not that I'm doing that because I think it's the right thing to do, or it's not doing that because I want to be free from those things from my history that have captured me. I want to be free from the transgenerational dynamics that have moved down through the generation and that have been put upon me when I was born. Yes, I want to be free from all that, and I want to take care of that, and I want to deal with that. But that's not in the bodhicitta. That's not the whole thing. The other part of that is I want to do that. I want to move in that direction, and I want to be as healthy as I can possibly be for this reason, so that I can turn around and help others move along that path. So that my purpose and my direction in life isn't just about myself for the sake of myself. It's about myself being healthy to help take care and others and bring them along, in this language, to the path of enlightenment, which reduces suffering. It's a heartfelt wish to deal with that. And then if you like rules, you'll love this. If you don't like rules, I know I'm talking to Unitarian Universalists. If you don't like rules, you're going to have a lot to detach from. We can maybe do more of that when we come back. But there's 18 rules that you got to look at so that you don't have a downfall. And then there's 46 more rules you have to look at so you don't have a downfall. And then they're based on 5 precepts that you're supposed to do. I mean, it's
very daunting.
It's daunting. It is. That's why you can't read that and just get. But one, and then I'll move on. But one I thought was great. One of the downfalls, root downfall, is not destroying places such as towns. That's the 10th one in the list. I thought, what in the world? Not destroying places such as towns. But then I go back to the universe reflecting upon itself, and there's not a subject-object relationship. There's only subject-subject relationships. It's not talking about, and I'm reading this from a very individualistic position about who I am. I can't destroy towns, but as a group of people, but as a nation, but as a person who participates in a community, I can destroy towns. I mean, we do that all the time. And you look at any imperialistic nation through time, they destroy towns for the resources, for whatever reason. So it breaks us out of being highly individualistic. And I'll conclude today with two key concerns for this bodhicitta decision, for a decision to clean my own house, in a way, clean myself psychologically and spiritually for the purposes of being able to help others. These are two key principles. The one is called shamelessness. But shamelessness, in this frame of reference, is the lack of concern about our own well-being. That's first. To confront our lack of concern about our own well-being. Two, the lack of consideration for others. I think there are Unitarian Universalist principles. I think if we go back to you are positioned in a particular history and we're going to engage in a dialogue with other histories to see if those other histories have something that could help us. But also to say to other histories, no, we don't want that. We might not want the rapture belief in our church. You know, we don't want that. Some people do. We might not. But this belief, I think, can be helpful to us. That we become concerned for our own well-being. And I'll bet you 90% of us know 3 things in our heads right now that we're concerned about our own well-being and we're not attending to. Maybe. So we know where to start. So whatever idea came to your head, you know where to start. And the second is just to be concerned and considerate for others. Well, that's enough for today.